agenda item 13, right? Status report on once-through cooling and desalination permitting. Frankly, I don't know why we're discussing this. I thought
well,
we were
I will
done
keep
with
it brief.
The state board took this from us.
Chair Young, members of the board, I'm Peter Von Langen, staff at the Water Board. It's just a brief staff report that is in your packet, item 13. And apparently you read your staff reports, so I will keep this very short.
Okay.
And as you said, the state board has taken once through cooling power plant permitting from the regional board. In 2010, they made a state board once through cooling policy. And this was brought about to try and comply with the federal 316B Clean Water Act regulations that deal with impingement and entrainment of marine life through large power plants. Impingement is where large organisms are trapped against the screens, and entrainment is when smaller organisms get damaged or killed by going through the once-through cooling system. The state board policy adopted in 2010 has two tracks of compliance. Track one is basically going to a closed-cycle cooling system, while track two is to use operational or structural controls to reduce impingement and entrainment to levels commensurate with going to closed-cycle cooling, something like 93% reduction in entrainment. The state board policy has grid reliability team to make sure that any shutdown of a power plant will not impact the California state energy grid. And there's also a nuclear review committee to deal with the special cases of the two nuclear power plants in the state, San Onofre down in San Diego and Diablo Canyon in our region. The three power plants in our region have been delayed for many years of being repermitted because of the impingement and entrainment issues and the 316B rules that have been held up in litigation and remanded. The power plants in the new state board policy, Morro Bay has until 2015 to comply, Moss Landing has until 2017 to comply, and Diablo Canyon has until 2024 to come up with either going to closed cycle cooling or doing other alternative methods to reduce impingement and entrainment. There's been some talk recently from state board staff that the state board is interested in reverting power plant permitting possibly next year back to the regional boards, but that's yet to be determined.
Would that include the nuclear plants or just the conventional?
It would include all plants, the three plants in our region, the Diablo Canyon, Morro Bay, and Moss Landing. The Nuclear Review Committee, though, they have there's a study coming out that'll be decided next year in 2013 how the Diablo Canyon power plant will comply with the policy, whether it's feasible to go to closed cycle cooling or other methods. Like once through cooling in power plants, the intake of surface water for desalination is also controversial, and the state board is coming up with the state board desalination policy, as you heard earlier from state board liaison and Mr. Moore. This policy is a high priority for the state board and should be adopted in early 2013. The policy takes into account the intake of seawater or surface waters for desalination and also deals with the brine discharge, which can be toxic to aquatic life, especially if it settles down, being higher density than seawater. There's several desalination facilities proposed in our region as well as throughout the state, and we have a speaker here, Dr. Carol Reeb, who has a high interest in desalination research, and she's planning on giving a short presentation here momentarily, and she will give a better overview of some of the impacts that can be associated with desalination. We also have Dr. Pete Raimondi over here, who is on the expert review panel for intakes and the entrainment and impingement impacts, and he also has some experience with desal brine discharge studies. There's a couple of representatives here as well from PG&E and Dynegy who are also available if any questions are needed about the power plants in our region. So without further ado, Dr. Kel Reeb over here will give a short presentation.
So, Peter, when would we see these issues come back to us? Is it determined that the state board is it's not determined that we're going to get them? Probably. Okay. So one would be then you gave dates for each of our three plants having to come in compliance with these new regs. At what point would we see these before the board in relation to those dates?
If it was, it's to be determined by the decision from State Board. When State Board, if they make the determination to give the power plant permitting back to the regions, then we would come up with a plan to permit these facilities as soon as possible.
As soon as, so well before their due dates to come into compliance with the regs?
Yes.
Okay.
Does that also include the desals?
Is
it all in same?
The desal will be a different time schedule. We're still responsible for desalination permitting in our region, but we're going to wait for the State Board desalination policy next year so we have clear guidance on how to proceed with the permitting of the facilities to deal with the impacts from the brine discharge and the impingement and entrainment and mitigation for this impingement and entrainment.
Okay. I have several questions on that, but I'll wait.
Okay. So go ahead.
Oscar, 15, please.
15. Hi, I'm Dr. Carol Reeb. I'm at Hopkins Marine Station, which is part of Stanford University. And, Mr. Chair, I was invited here by Mr. Briggs to discuss brine discharge and its impact on marine environments. I was incorrectly noted in the agenda as being on the brine expert panel, but I wasn't. I actually was invited to speak to that panel specifically on brine discharge and its impact to marine creatures, especially fisheries species. So, anyway, I'd like to get the first slide. Oh. Okay. Oh, well, anyway, along the Central Coast, most of the desalination is focused right now in Monterey Bay. Cambria does have a plant they were considering, but I think it's off the table for the moment. Nonetheless, there are three plants currently operating in Monterey Bay, and they're such small plants, the impact's negligible. I don't think there's any concern over this at all. However, in the future, in the next slide, it could be quite a few coming. Right now, these ones shown in the Moss Landing and Marina area are plants that are planned. One of them should be built, we anticipate, to meet the needs of the Monterey Peninsula's water crisis looming in 2016. The other one in Soquel Creek is another one that's under consideration. It may be going to the voters this November. But in the future, this entire area is going to be under a water shortage with planned growth, both in Santa Cruz, Watsonville, Marina. So there's actually lots of plants all on paper or being discussed that could actually be quite impactful. And I'm here today to talk about specifically seawater and brackish water desalination. Reverse osmosis purification on wastewater does not produce the volume or the salinity of brines that these seawater plants will produce. So wastewater desalination is actually less impactful, in my opinion, than seawater. Next slide. A lot of people are concerned about impingement entrainment, which, as shown here, is the taking in of animals and algae and other things. But I'm actually more concerned about, you know, when you take things in, that some of these components actually end up in the brine itself. So throughout the world, there's been many instances of jellyfish and algae clogging plants and shutting them down for months. In Saudi Arabia, it was actually shut down water facilities for 8 months, and water prices soared. In February this year, there was a scientific workshop on desalination as it is impacted by harmful algae blooms and red tide. And specifically in this workshop, it was talked about how algal toxins brought into the plant can actually end up in the brine concentrated two times more than they are typically in the ambient waters. And so when you think about the algae toxins, it could actually be a real serious problem. Some of those toxins cause paralytic shellfish poisoning. Saxitoxin is one. We have saxitoxin in Monterey Bay. Potentially it can occur, and also domoic acid is very harmful to marine mammals. In Monterey Bay, this is a series of slides taken from the satellite to show chlorophyll that track the harmful algae bloom in 2007. This is over 6 weeks. You can see how it oftentimes these blooms start around the Elkhorn Slough area, and they can spread out across the entire bay. So Monterey Bay has been called a red tide incubator because of the recurring nature of these blooms. And they're often linked, the massive blooms are often linked to coastal pollution. And in the future, it's anticipated that climate warming will increase the frequency of these events. Reverse osmosis is the removal of salt through high pressure forcing of water against the salt gradient. And it leaves behind basically an equal volume of brine. So for every acre foot of brine or potable water you generate, you basically generate an equal acre foot of brine. So if in the future Monterey Bay or the Central Coast were to have 60,000 acre feet of potable water produced, just remember there's 60 to 70 thousand acre feet of brine that's just charged into the sea. And in Monterey Bay is about 136,000 acres. And if you're putting 60,000 acres into that enclosed, semi-enclosed basin, we need to understand in the future how this is going to impact the species there. What are the long-term cumulative impacts? What are the vulnerable species? How are we going to mitigate problems? What are the problems we should anticipate? Right now, there's so much we don't know in our science that it's really hard to tell you exactly what to expect. But the next series of slides, I'm going to show you what's been found in other parts of the world, and it's just something we should think about. When we dispose of brine offshore, it contains, of course, salt, but it also contains chemicals that are used in the cleaning process of the plant. And then, of course, there's the algal toxins that may be in there, concentrated as well. So species have a choice. They can move, adapt, or die. Animals that can actually get up and move, you know, that's not a problem. But some of these animals are anchored to the seafloor. In the case of some species, such as the California squid, they anchor their eggs to the seafloor in Monterey Bay and along the California coast, and they can't get up and move until they've gone through their hatching, which is about 6 to 8 weeks later. So they're kind of stuck in that brine plume as long as it persists. Now, I want to talk about osmosis, which is in nature the forward process, not the reverse. When you add salt to one side of a semipermeable membrane, basically it throws off the water balance or salt balance, and water will move to an area of low salt to high salt to equal out the concentration. So basically you dehydrate the cell. It requires no energy. There is desalination technology that takes advantage of this, but it's not ready for municipal use yet. In nature, what happens is you put salt on an animal, it basically dehydrates. The larger animals, the adults, typically have enough energy reserves to overcome this. They can pump salt back using enzyme-mediated enzymes or aquaporins and chaperones to move the water back, or they can also use salt pumps to equal out the salt balance. But on the small, young life stages, it's not always they don't always have the energy to do that. Okay, let's slow down. So when we think of salinity in marine life, the oceans around the world pretty much fall within 31 to 40 parts per thousand, and I've just shown this here. Monterey Bay is about 32 to 34. Reverse osmosis brine from seawater intake ranges about 55 to 70. And I put the Salton Sea and Mono Lake there just to give you a reference point of where this salinity coming out of a seawater desal plant falls in terms of what might live in this water. It wouldn't be tunas or a squid or anything like that. There are the three plants I talked about in Monterey Bay. The Sand City plant uses brackish intake, and its discharge actually goes into ground wells. But even so, it's actually less dense than seawater, so it's not a problem. Monterey Bay Aquarium dilutes its water with seawater, and what it discharges is near the salinity of the Mediterranean Sea. Santa Cruz has a proposed seawater desal plant, which they will dilute their brine with wastewater, and that comes out around the Red Sea concentration. So when we think about distributions of animals in the ocean, temperature is the first controlling factor that dominates their distributional patterns. Salinity is the second. In the terms, I want to use the Marina Water Project, since it's now off the table, as a case study to explain to you my concerns really about what could happen with brine. In this project, the brine was estimated to be between 53 and 62 parts per thousand discharge. And they were going to mix this with wastewater and discharge it through a 2-mile-long sewer pipe with diffusers at the end. There was, of course, some concern over this. You would be putting 50 to 60 parts per thousand into a bay that's 34. the first thing it would do is sink. So they ran a diffusion model to look at, to see what the impacts would be. And they ran this model using 62 parts per thousand through a sewer pipe and concluded that the maximum salinity would be 36.8 parts per thousand. The problem I saw with this is that this is only the first few moments of discharge. What happens if we let this run for several days or several years or several decades? So I asked a colleague to look at this. Dr. Brock Woodson, who's a civil engineer at Stanford, took a 2D hydrodynamic model and used the same parameters, except that he also included a semi-diurnal tidal flow of 10 centimeters per second, which is a dominant current found in Monterey Bay in summer. And so we thought maybe this current could help mix this brine plume a little bit better than the worst-case scenario, which is what was used in the EIR. And so we ran it for a couple of days. And what you see on the first day is that dilution is actually quite good right at the point of discharge. It's about 36, 37 parts per thousand. But by day five, the dark red colors on the bottom represent salinities near 40, and it persists and it rocks back and forth with the tide. So it doesn't just magically disappear. This is actually, you know, a little bit alarming to us. Okay, so in Spain, I hate to bring up the concept of environmental monitoring after all I've listened to today, but maybe we might need to consider doing this, especially on new plants built in the near future, just so we can get some baseline information on how brine plumes might behave along the central coast. Go back. In Spain, there's a great dependence on seawater desalination, and there's also a problem with Mediterranean seagrasses because they're highly sensitive to brine. In fact, the seagrass meadows provide habitat for a lot of the fishery species that are in Spain. So there was some science-based laboratory studies to look at how these seagrasses responded to brine, and then the government used science-based policy to establish a regulation whereby brine discharge must be no more than 5% above ambient salinities, and then they also imposed monitoring. So here you can see a desalination plant that produces 17 million gallons per day of brine. It's discharged offshore, not in just in the surf. And you can see this plume move out for miles. And in April, it moves a lot further than in January, so we presume there's a lot more storm mixing that near the shore that's diluting it better. And what is being done is that they're monitoring with instruments on the seafloor this 38.8 part per thousand threshold. And in the red, you can see where it's out of compliance, and where it's black, it's in compliance. So the whole point is to try to make sure this brine is less than 38.8 parts per thousand as it moves into the seagrass meadows. Okay, so when a brine sinks to the seafloor and spreads out and covers it, the other thing it can do is it can cut off oxygen exchange with the benthic community down underneath. So this is shown really well in Corpus Christi Bay, and it can cause hypoxia. So in Corpus Christi Bay, there's hypersaline lagoons that rim Corpus Christi Bay, and in summer they spill over. So the red color to the left is high salinity brine around 50 parts per thousand. It spills into the bay, that's 34, and then layers it on the seafloor. And you can see the color differences. It's about 36 to 42 parts per thousand salinity. What happens is that this brine is impervious to wind mixing. It's difficult to model with oceanographic models. And what it does is it creates persistent hypoxia that can occur about a mile or more away from the actual brine discharge point. So you can see that in this lower panel. The dark blues are actually parts per or milligrams per liter of dissolved oxygen in area down to, well, 2 parts per million is considered lethal to marine life. So where it's really, really dark blue, that's where it's really lethal. So anyway, this doesn't go away. and this is also a big concern. So what does this mean to animals on the seafloor on the central coast? Well, Monterey Bay and actually the whole coastline of California is a squid nursery for California market squid, which are also a major fishery in terms of driving local economies. So what I did with a colleague, Lou Zyberg, who's a squid expert, we looked at We design an experiment based on toxicity studies of salt in other species and looked at how salt would impact hatching rates of squid eggs collected from Monterey Bay. And this is sort of a preliminary study. We haven't published it. We're following up with more experiments. But nonetheless, what we found was a little bit surprising. 45 to 50 parts per thousand salt was actually when you first start seeing the negative impacts of hatching. And what we measured was hatchability. We didn't care if it was alive or dead. As long as it came out of the egg case, we counted it. And this is important. And these results are very similar to other toxicity testing being used right now to establish thresholds for brine. We're only looking at salt. No one's looking at dissolved oxygen, algal toxins, or cleaning chemicals in this brine. All the toxicity studies right now are looking only at salt. The other thing is we're only measuring lethal effects. In our study that we looked at with the 45 parts per 1,000 and 50, at 50, the animals didn't last for very long. They were pretty much dead within a few hours after hatching. The 45 part per 1,000 animals persisted, but most of them, a third of them would lie on the bottom of the container they were in, pretty much immobile. So there's sublethal effects that are not being measured, and sublethal effects in the lab could be lethal in the wild. So these are the environmental concerns that I and many marine scientists along the Central Coast have about seawater desalination. Yes, impingement and entrainment is a big problem and it needs to be mitigated, but think about what could be pulled in and then concentrated and put back out into the brine. We're not even looking at that. Hypoxia is a big issue, and the developing life stages. I just looked at squid, but there are other species on the seafloor that could be at risk. These all tie into the food chain, which actually, I also study swordfish. Squid provides food for swordfish. They provide food for Pacific salmon. When we think about the economy, it's also linked to the ecology of the bay and the coastal ocean. And so that could also have economic impacts. So.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question?
Sure.
Is there any look at the technology to blend the brackish water so we could lower the salinity level? It certainly would add more complexity into additional pumping, et cetera, but it would be diluting the discharge of a brine.
Yes, so in terms of the Marina Water District or the water project, they were going to dilute this with the wastewater. However, in summer, there's no wastewater to dilute it with because it's all recycled and used on farms. So they would have discharged undiluted brine directly into the bay. Also, given what was said earlier today, there's wastewater is becoming a valuable renewable water resource. So thinking of using it to dilute brine, it's pretty much you have to dilute it one-to-one.
I was thinking diluting seawater into
Then we get into the impingement entrainment that Dr. Raimondi could talk to you about and the fees associated with excess water intake. The thing that's preferred in Spain and also, well, actually Australia and less so in Spain, is high-velocity jet discharge through diffusers, and that seems to work pretty well compared to the other options. However, it takes a lot of energy, and you have to have a highly designed, expensive pipe to do that.
Right. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions. I'm over here.
Oh.
Here I am. You showed three projects in the Monterey Bay, which I'm really interested in. Cal-Am's project is slant wells, which is not taking directly seawater, and their disposal is through the regional sewage facilities. And I agree with you that the dilution rate would change during the summertime because they use the recycled water in agriculture in the Salinas Valley and Castroville area. And I think I understood you say that it would be better to have it mixed with sewage water than just direct disposal. Is that, did I?
That's the plan, but I don't think I would. I think recycled water, either as a potable supply or for ag, I think that the wastewater is 99% fresh water. It takes less energy to take the constituents out of that through reverse osmosis than it does seawater. I just look at the wastewater as a valuable resource in the future, and I just don't see how people would be willing to let it go to dilute brine.
I agree with you 100%. Can I go on to the deep water?
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about the intake. I'm talking about the discharge, because it uses Dynalgy's, proposed Dynalgy's discharge facilities in Moss Landing.
Right off, yeah, Moss Landing.
Right,
off in Barrie.
I chair the Moss Landing Harbor District, and that's why I'm really interested.
Oh, okay.
And the People's Project, which is also adjacent. Now, both of those are close to the Monterey Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding that once discharge reaches the Monterey Canyon, it disappears and it really doesn't make any difference. Have you done any scientific analysis to that?
No, but I've had many scientific discussions about it. Somebody needs to model that, because when you think about discharging heavy, dense brine, it's actually better to put it on the surface and let it fall down and turbulently mix to get, you know, that'll maximize mixing, as opposed to putting it on a seafloor that has no energy to mix it. And so if you were to discharge it and it falls down the canyon, one would imagine, oh, it would sort of mix up as it rolls down 4,000 meters or whatever. And Dr. Raimondi could comment on this too, potentially, but there are internal waves in that canyon that push water up during certain times of the year.
And just the opposite the other way.
And, yeah, so there might be times where it's really good to discharge it into the canyon, but there could be other times where, as it accumulates down deep in the canyon, there could be an internal wave that potentially pushes it back
brings
up onto the shore.
Oh, I see.
So
okay.
This is – no one's done the modeling. No one's done – but it's something we've thought about, and therefore, if you were to do this, you'd want to do the modeling first.
Okay. And dilution rate, did I hear 5%? Is that –
In the expert brine panel recommendations, they have suggested that 5% above ambient be the threshold. In Spain, it is legally the threshold. And in Australia, in some cases, it's the threshold that has to be met.
My other concern is that once the desal, not only the salts, but I'm concerned about all the other chemicals that would be, I wouldn't say packaged, but they would be clustered together in a higher consistency. Has anybody done any analysis on that?
No. No, and this is a missing link in the brine toxicity studies right now. People are simply looking at salts, or in some cases they are using desalination brine, but no one's put in low oxygen or algal toxins or all of the cleaning solutions that could potentially end up in it.
Okay, thank you.
Mayor Delgado.
Thank you for that whirlwind tour you gave. When brine is disposed, is it a solid, a liquid, or a combination?
It's a liquid.
Okay.
It's kind of behaves like a syrup as you discharge it into the water.
All right. What are the options for disposing it other than putting it in a local water source?
The smaller plants, you could actually think about drying it out in ponds and recovering salts. There's I tell some people that there's actually gold in seawater. And a cubic mile of seawater has hundreds of millions of dollars of gold. But that's not practical for large plants. And I think I've sort of been in discussion. There's one of the problems with reverse osmosis is the efficiency is only 44 to 50% conversion. If we could develop a technology that, so for you, increases the efficiency, so wastewater, we can recover 85 to 90% of the water from a gallon. Seawater, we only recover 44 to 50%. So I think the incentives to develop the technology further, desal technology, reverse osmosis was developed in the 80s, and it hasn't really evolved since then. That would be an option to try to figure out ways to create zero brine discharge. The other way is to keep plants small and try to find ways to dry out the salts in ponds. Or I think a basin can tolerate smaller discharge, but the larger ones, there's going to be a limit where if there's too much brine coming into a basin, it's going to be a problem. I think we have to figure out what the threshold is of a basin that it can tolerate, and no one's done that research either. So you know, I think a little bit more science research into this might help us figure out what plant size would be ideal for a particular discharge site and a particular basin.
Once dried, what happens to it?
There's value. So potassium is a really valuable salt. You could sell it. I mean, there's sea salts that people buy in the store. there's all kinds of things you could get from it. The other thing you could do with brine is you can create electricity. You can generate a electric current from a low salt concentration to a high salt concentration, and that's kind of how a battery works. One can imagine in the future you could take the brine and create a little power plant out of it too. So there's things that can be done. Just discharging it into the ocean has been the simplest, cheapest option for now. But if there's regulations that come down the pipe, companies may be given the incentive to make more use of it. Sort of like sewage used to be a waste. Now we're recycling it for water. I think brine in the future will be the same.
Thank you very much.
Okay. You know, I had one question. One of your photographs showed the algal bloom starting right near Moss Landing.
Mm-hmm.
Is that area being influenced by the discharge from the Salinas River kind of helping to create the bloom?
There has been a link between nitrate discharge and red tides. Specifically for Monterey Bay, people might argue, but there seems to be a link. It seems to be linked to first flush, first rains, yeah. And that's why these blooms often happen in fall.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Peter, what else do we have? Do you have for us?
Just to follow up on your question about the harmful algal bloom. Yes, there is a link from the discharge from agriculture there, and there's a normal counterclockwise current that goes up towards Capitola, and there's less circulation up in that area of the northern Monterey Bay, so it allows the doubling rate of the harmful algae to increase, and that's why you get a bloom up there in that Senkus report. Dr. Raimondi also has more to add regarding the discharge of brine near the submarine cannon. He says he's been working on a study with that, yeah. If you'd like to hear.
Questions on the intakes as well on those. But, you know, I'd just like to remind the board over the years that we have given PG&E settlement funds to the Elkhorn Foundation to purchase agriculture property surrounding that to take away the nitrates because the strawberry farm we're discharging, and that has helped considerably. So there has been some rewards for our efforts on dispersing that money to the Elkhorn Foundation, the Elkhorn Salute Foundation.
Good. Okay. We're going to hear from Dr. Raimondi. We haven't seen you
for a while.
A few years.
Yeah. So I just want to clarify something. I agree with almost everything that Carol said. With respect to the Moss Landing power plants, they're following a kind of a protocol that's going on throughout the state. I've been working on desal plants now throughout the state, and the real threshold is how big they are, and you alluded to that, and what they do with their water as they get bigger. And most of the bigger ones, Poseidon comes to mind down in Southern California, co-locate with some other sort of discharge, typically with a power plant. And right now the thought, at least some of the thinking at the Moss Landing, is to mix the brine discharge with the effluent that's coming out of the Moss Landing power plant. That's one of the possibilities. And the reason for that is because they got to get it diluted. You know, they need to dilute the water down to a low threshold. And that is, that comes out of a riser that's just offshore from Mbari. You can see it bubbling there. But it's a very effective way to dilute the brine, because Moss Landing is such a huge power plant. It's taking in 1,200 million gallons of water a day. And so when you're diluting it with that much seawater, it gets it down to a low level. The intake is close to the canyon. The discharge is close to the canyon, but it would not probably get down into the canyon. So they're separated a little bit spatially. So I just want to make that clarification. If you have any questions about intake.
Yes, I just want to ask you a question about the deep water.
Yeah.
And their proposed project, they're planning on using a pipeline that'll be out far enough that we'll not have any larvae or any type.
That's not right.
Pardon?
They're proposing to put an intake structure in about 100 feet of water. They don't know whether there's going to be any larvae there. And, in fact, what they have enabled a group to get together, Tenera, out of San Luis Obispo, actually is doing the pilot study to actually determine what the larval concentrations are at depth. their thinking is that there's going to be lower numbers of larvae at depth, and so the entrainment in particular will be much less than it would be if you had the intake at 30 feet. That may be true. It may also not be true. It's just like what Carol was indicating about other things. We just don't have that level of information. But they are proposing to do a study to figure that out. The real issue is not whether there's more or less, which it'd be great if there's less, but if they're a different species composition and you're taking things that are rare. It's the rarity that is the problem with these things. Not so much, it's, you know, taking goby larvae is not the same thing as taking boccaccio larvae. And the concern is that you're going to be taking species that are already rare and that they're coming up the canyon. And so that's one of the things that will have to be worked out.
Going along with that, then, if the orders come down that the ones through cool for power plants are gone,
yeah,
then that analysis goes away because there wouldn't be that much to mix from the power plant.
You would think. However, that is an open question. So I'm going to talk about Poseidon. That's located at Agua Hediondo. And the actual 316B like, it's not because there's no such thing as a 316B for desal, anticipated that the pumps would continue to run in order to cause there to be the dilution that is required for the desal plant. So although there would be no power generation after a certain point in time and there wouldn't be as much water taken through, the pumps would continue to run to provide the adequate dilution for the Poseidon power plant because that's a big one. It's about 160 million gallons. So, and they would need to dilute it 2-to-1 in order to meet the requirements for the brine discharge.
So this would be the same analysis that Dynalgy, that they would continue to keep the pumps running even if they're not providing energy? Is this what I'm hearing?
If it's coupled to an existing power plant and they need that to meet the brine discharge, the pumps have to keep running.
Ah, interesting. And have you investigated the People's Project at Moss Landing?
No, I've been working with the Coastal Commission only on the Deepwater
Desal. Okay. Mm-hmm. You'll eventually get those then once they...
Eventually they'll come up. You know, if they go forward with them, you know, what's going to happen is that before they go forward with much, they want to figure out what the likely environmental considerations are so that they're informed when they bring it before whoever is regulating it at that point. The Coastal Commission certainly will have a say. The water boards and the State Water Board will also.
Okay. Dr. Hunter and then Mr. Johnston.
Thank you. Good to see you again, Dr. Monday. I think last time I saw you was when I had just joined the board and learned soon after that we weren't going to be deciding that permit for Diablo Canyon, so didn't get a chance to really dig into it. But we're glad to have you back. I realize that we're talking about a water supply issue and what you just brought out in terms of a co-location issue for power plants that may, under 316B, have to change their operation. What are your views on the long-term viability of building our water supply, stability of our water supply based on outdated or outmoded technologies? And without asking you to advocate, you know, for the kind of moral issues that go along with that, I mean, is that viable? Do you see that as being a viable direction?
This is a super easy question for me because I don't know. I mean, I am a biologist and somewhat of a math person, and so I've been mainly working on assessing the impacts resulting from these activities, and I really don't have any insight into that question at all.
Do you think that having the role that you play over time, is that discussion being held in terms of the policy and in terms of looking at the best way to structure desal in the coastal region?
In the ones that I've been working on, the major issue has not been that one. There's been two major issues. One is, given that there's going to be desal, because usually we get involved in these projects after there's been sort of a tacit agreement that if the environmental concerns are met, then there will be desal. What are those impacts? And then the second big issue is this new water or is it replacement water? Mm-hmm. And that's really a very heated political decision. But those have been the two topical discussion points.
Well, I would comment my observation and the dialogue that I've heard over many years is the idea that we would co-locate and thus tie those antiquated power plants, once they're cooling power systems, to water supply would cause other kinds of complications economically and environmentally. So,
well, one of the big issues, and is again following up on this, is that when you need to get the brine diluted somehow, and there's two ways to do this. Sometimes they both operate. One is you do it with existing water discharges, and so by the time it gets to the diffusers, it's essentially diluted. The other is that you use diffuser technology to dilute it into the receiving water. Most of the bigger plants are using the dilute it before it gets to the discharge. And there's only one major source, other than if you're fortunate enough to be close to wastewater discharge, that's power plants, because they take in huge amounts of water. And so it's, they've been, and big plants need a lot of water to get it down to the dilution standards.
Right. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Johnston.
Politics and water? I'm shocked.
Yeah.
So if I understood you correctly, you were saying that one of the options appears to be even where you have power plants that have once-through cooling systems, even where the power plant would stop using that water for cooling to co-locate and then to use that water for dilution.
I'm not indicating that is a proposal. I'm just indicating that the big ones that have been actually permitted at this point have used that.
Right. So here's my question. I would assume you still have the same technical issues around impingement because you're still sucking a lot of water in.
We need to be careful here because impingement usually is not an issue. It's entrainment that is usually
right.
the issue.
I'm getting to entrainment.
Okay. Yep.
But if all you're doing is running the water through pumps, blending and sending it back out, how much of an entrainment, and you're not running it through the heating process, I guess you still have an entrainment issue, both from the pumps and from the sudden change in salt content that whatever gets sucked in is subjected to. Does it really change much as far as the entrainment issues if you switch off the power plant but are diluting brine with it?
There's two answers. One is not legally. Legally, there is the assumption of 100% what they call through plant mortality. That has been an underlying assumption for all considerations. There have been a few studies that have looked at whether that's an actual valid assumption. The real issue really is not even heat as much as acceleration. So what happens is that when you go through the pumps, they tend at some point to get through narrower gauge pipes. And at that point, you get a huge acceleration, and it tends to emulsify, some of these guys. Heat is an obvious issue in some of the plants, but there are some plants that even they run sometimes at not that hot a temperature. They go into the receiving waters at 15 to above ambient, and for certain species of fish, that's survivable. But when they have actually sampled them, they tend not to be in good enough shape to survive. And a lot of it is,
if they're turning off the power plant and using that intake and outflow for dilution, it really doesn't change, it sounds like,
it
either
could.
The impingement or the entrainment questions dramatically.
It could, but not using what is current plant technology. All they really need is that water for dilution. If they peeled off the water before it went through the typical pumps, if it was a different pump structure, and then just remixed it, if they brought in three parts, peeled off two of it, took one in, made desalinated it, and the brine then mixed with the two parts that just bypassed it, and it didn't go through these more complicated pump systems, there has been a discussion about just that sort of diversion and then dilution, in which case there's a high chance that you would have a lot of survivorship of the larvae.
You'll have to go through pumps of some sort.
Some sort, but you could use peristalt. There's a whole bunch of different technologies that would allow it to be much more, survivable.
And you'd still have a sudden increase in salt levels.
It depends. You're really talking, like at Moss Landing, you're talking about, they're talking about 25 million gallons of the, you know, for desal, and they're pumping 1,200 million gallons a day. That's not, you know, it's raising the salinity not very much.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, I'd like to draw this to a close. I'll give you 30 seconds. But we,
just my fair share. I'm not even going to be a fraction of the time of some of my colleagues.
We got to get out of here by 5.
I know.
We're not done with our agenda.
It's a matter of
go ahead,
fairness for
quickly.
All of us. just as a excuse me, as a clarification on the pumps, you know, some of the older technology impellers certainly are very damaging, but there are new technologies such as diaphragm pumps, and you know, it's basically the same concept of a heart valve. It's a much larger pump, but it's not designed for high velocity. It's low velocity, high volume. So all I'm saying is there are technology in the horizon to address the issue you talked about.
That's exactly what we've been discussing, is new pump technology.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me that clarification.
You're welcome, Dr. Wolf, anytime, when it's brief. Okay. I think that concludes that item, Mr. Briggs.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Peter, and thank you for the other Peter and Carol.
And thank you, waiting for all afternoon.
Yeah.